My guest today is Reena Singh, founder of Eka Design Studio in India. Reena's roots are in rural North India, where she was raised within a culture of family and community craftsmanship, which continues to influence her. Reena works primarily with textile craftspeople in rural Western and Eastern India to develop natural, sustainable fabrics in modern but enduring silhouettes. Before launching Eka in 2011, she was assistant professor in NIFT, Gandhinagar, India, where she researched and developed indigenous Indian textile techniques. Reena gained a lot of insight on international fashion through her travels and work with international design studios. She is the first designer from India to collaborate with global apparel conglomerate Uniqlo for the launch of its first ever kurta collection across stores globally. Reena was awarded the Chairman's Scholarship from Wigan and Lee College to study fashion in the United Kingdom in 1998. Among many laurels, she has been awarded the Vogue Powerlist Minimalist Designer of the Year in 2019 and was featured in the Harper Bazaar's Women of the Year for 2019. From the free-spirited boarder to the passionate designer, let's listen firsthand to Reena's numerous anecdotes and a strong commitment to preserving the rich legacy of Indian craftsmanship. Hi, Reena. A very warm welcome to Atlanta Diaries. And thank you very much for partnering with me in this journey.
Thank you for having me. And I really enjoyed speaking with you the first time. I was in the middle of, I remember it was sort of a traffic situation when I said, can we do this call now or later? And I realized that call, which was meant to be just an introduction for about 5 minutes or so, went on for about an hour. I shared a lot. I think you gave me that comfortable space to open up. And like I said earlier, that I have never spoken so much about my journey, and I'm here, and I appreciate you reaching out and connecting so many women across the world. So I just feel extremely honored to be included, and thank you again.
You're so humble and kind, Reena, and let the audience decide where all this is coming from. So let's just get started, right?
Sure.
Awesome. Your journey is really courageous, and love for you to share. How did your early years shape your journey thus far?
My early years, honestly, and as we spoke earlier, is not really a big song that I would want to write about in the history of things. But I am a Rajput girl. And as you know, that the Rajput community is not very favoring of the female child. I was the second daughter in a household that perhaps really wanted to have a boy. And as it so happened, my mother passed away within the 2 years of my birth. I remember that I was passed around from my family to my maternal grandparents' house. And then from there, my early years were my boarding school years. The strongest memory I have is from my maternal grandparents' house. I mean, it's still the home that I go back to. I have a very strong connection with the village. We are agriculturists from both my father's and my mother's side of the family. So my father married my maternal aunt. So that household is literally a part of me. Like even now, if there is a crisis ever, I call my brothers and we kind of huddle and we sit together and we discuss everything there is to be discussed in life. The early years were shaped with the household values of a simple village, rural life. Needs and necessities are important. Wants don't figure. There is a lot of idle space and time. A lot of people are very creative. There is a lot of touch with the elements like earth, water, the air, nature. And also because I was in a boarding school, my education was perhaps kind of also detached from that overbearing parental support, I think. And therefore, maybe if I can look back, maybe that independence that I got from being a child outside of the realm of a father and a mother watching, and you know, the whole freedom of being what you want to be with the kind of value system in place. So I think that sort of worked. So that was, in a nutshell, a childhood.
And I'm just wondering, how did the creative journey start? You know, did you have any creative influences growing up? Talk to us about your education and training, which created this amazing brand called Eka.
I don't have role models to say that somebody was an artist or somebody was a filmmaker or somebody was a dancer. My father's side of the family, we are very deeply involved in education. My grandfather laid the foundation for the university in the small town of Kurukshetra. In fact, my chacha, a year ago, he got the Padma Shri from the government of India. Creativity, I think, really crafty things were everyday routine. Like I would see women who would finish their household chores, sit in the afternoon and weave the handheld bamboo fans, or they would make baskets. The ladies of the house would every afternoon sit and spin yarns from cotton, and a local dyer would come, take the yarns, dye it in really nice colors. How the food was stored, how the food was grown. So there was a lot of craft and culture around me when I was growing up. And there was a lot of freedom to be a part of everything. And I think reading came from my father's side of the family. When I would go visit my uncles, like I would see big libraries in their homes. And I was always fascinated. Although education was not something that I was privileged to have, like in a household like ours, it's not encouraged. It's not easy for girls to really study. While I was still writing my grade 12 exams, my parents found a suitable match and I was married off. So I was married into a royal family in Jodhpur. And education was definitely not promised and not encouraged. I had to fight for it. I was very passionate about it. And the more it was denied, the more it became like a fruit that I really, really wanted to have. So I pursued it. Also, I was good in studies. I was always very disciplined and diligent. So I pursued it, I fought for it, and I made sure that I have it.
So what was the result? You know, like you said, it was difficult to get, but you did manage it and more.
So yeah, I wasn't allowed to study further. At one time, I remember that one of the closest person in the family said that you want to be a professor or you want to have a degree over my dead body. At another instance, I remember a few days before my exams, my book was thrown out because it was apparently forbidden. And me doing it was challenging a lot of authority. And at one point, because I had my first child, a boy at the age of 18, after I was married, and one person said that you've made us very happy. Would you like to study further? And I thought that that was the best gift I could ask for. I said, yes. So he said, yes, it is allowed, but you can't go to college. You can't wear your, you know, denims and your pants. And I said, that's okay. He said, correspondence, have you heard of how you study in correspondence? I said, I don't know. This was some person from my in-laws family. He said, I studied correspondence. You just sit at home, you get your books, you study and you write exams. And I felt I was scared. I was very nervous. I was like, am I the person who could sit at home, read books and go and write exams? Of course, I've read about it in lots of books of literature. And a lot of genius people used to do that. But I never thought I was capable of it, you know. And I was still a girl who was from the boarding school, who was free-spirited, who used to chat up with her friends, lunch breaks and things. So, but I was like, just take what you're being given. I studied economics and psychology and I excelled. I was a distinction holder then. Before I could write my final exams, an incident broke everything and I could barely write my exam because I was kind of in a very bad physical shape. But I knew that that was the only chance I had to graduate or not. So in really difficult circumstances, I made sure that I gave my last exam. I didn't have any books and I could only write what I could remember. So yeah, that's how the graduation happened. I got a degree. And with that, I landed in Delhi. I came to Delhi thinking that I'll make something of my life here. And my brother was younger to me, but he's very supportive. And he always believed in me for some reason. We are like, in that sense, we are a big family. We are four siblings. I have an older sister, one younger sister and a brother. there's a lot of hostility and there is a lot of hatred and there's a lot of misunderstanding. But well, you cannot miss the fact that there is also a lot of love and support. So in those times, there was this fashion education college that was opening its private wing in India. They were conducting a written exam. I just went to Delhi because my brother wanted to buy his clothes from this famous market. I said, I'm going to come along with you, but don't tell anyone I'm going to write this exam. And I got through, and then I told my parents. And then I got a scholarship. And I think that decided for me, because I didn't even know what to say in the interview when they asked me, who are the international famous designers that you know of and what you like of their work? I knew nothing, honestly. But I got through and I got a scholarship to study further on in UK. And I think that sort of set the path where I stand today.
Awesome. We are talking about a time when there was no internet. So I can understand when you're saying that I had no names to share. Now we can do this at the drop of a hat. Let's talk about Eka. So I love the name. It's so unique. It's so simple. Yet what inspired the name Eka?
So, you know, a lot of times, you know, Enma, what happens is that all these iconic things, you know, when you look back and you feel, why did you do this? Yeah. In that moment, you wouldn't have thought so deeply. We don't recognize it in that moment. So Eka happened. Why? Because I was looking for a name, and my husband now.
Yeah.
We studied together and I married the second time many years later. We share the similar values. We studied fashion together. We interned together. We were on scholarship in UK together. I was with him in college from 22, and we got married when I was 35. So we kind of impressed on each other, I feel. Great deal. So his company was called Eon. And if you ask him, why is it called Eon? He wouldn't have an answer. So I felt like that went on to infinity. So I could be the starting point, and it just felt so right. And I thought about it more because I knew that what I wanted to do had something to do with how we are as a people, you know, like I had great ideas about world and what kind of footprint we could have in the world of fashion internationally and this and that. And yet where I sit and where I come from is something so different, unique, and I feel extremely authentic and original space that I come from culturally and in terms of how India is in its entire width and breadth. So I felt that everything that could come together in that one language that I wanted to create. So it just became Eka, one. It's one, which is ache in many languages. It just felt right in that moment.
So given the authentic you and sustainability, was there like a clear vision or a value system which you were very clear that you're not going to compromise on?
You know, largely, Enma, India is an extremely frugal and a sustainable nation. You know it. You've lived here. Largely. In fact, I think we've been spoiled last 10 years. But if you see the wardrobes of our grandmothers or our mothers even, I mean, they would buy a sari for Diwali, a sari maybe for a childbirth, a sari for their wedding anniversaries, and maybe at the time when their daughters are getting married or whatever, you know, and somebody else is getting married, so they get a sari. This is how they accumulate. We are not consumers like that. We don't consume and throw things. We're extremely frugal. Like I've lived in households and I've lived in places where I remember when I was in Gandhinagar, one district in Gujarat, you know, in the neighborhood, there was this provision shop. Like we used to get these packets of milk, and every packet that you would collect and take back would give you like 1 rupee, 2 rupee. And in the end, about 12 packets would give you one packet of milk. That's how frugal and sustainable the country is. And in the kitchen balcony, you would see those milk packets literally clipped.
Yep.
There is like a huge bag of trash and there's a bigger bag of polythenes. That's all put together so that you reuse. You don't buy. When I was in the boarding school and my nani would send me big dabba of steel ka dabba of this dessert, she would put it in a one steel ka dabba and then she would put that box in a cotton ka kapde ka thela potli and she would send it. I would feel really awkward that, you know, oh wow, this is super rural.
Right.
But this is how we've lived. I don't think I inculcated these values, but whether or not I was always confident about them to do what I'm doing today in fashion, I can't say that. I think that came with experience, age, and applying myself in fashion through learnings and a lot of lessons while being around in the industry. So I didn't start my label immediately after I passed out. I worked at NIFT, with National Institute of Fashion Technology, where I did a lot of research work and I did a lot of projects and I traveled the length, width and breadth of the country, especially Gujarat actually at that time. And then I joined ITC. With that company, I traveled a lot of international shows and markets. And I saw what fashion meant to the world. And I more and more started feeling confident about my place in the world. So my place is not just me. My place is my entirety. My place is my people, my culture, where I come from, my roots, my values, the crafty afternoons that yielded whatever in my head. Then I felt there is this voice in my head that just needs an expression. And I thought that that woman needed a voice. And that's how Eka and what I make with Eka. And the voice of Eka, I think, was very, very clear to me.
You know, if I may say so, Eka is not a conventional look. Okay. You don't even look like a conventional designer. I'm just wondering, it's very intentional, the brand, the planning, the becoming, and so on. Were there any people who sort of doubted you or your plan and thought?
You know, so Eka is not the first struggle. It's not the first dream, or it's not the first journey that I took listening to the voice in my head. It is one of the several that I took. Perhaps it came after many turbulent such journeys. So I think the people did not match up to the vision and the passion of what life has to give. I'm not saying silenced, but I did not give a lot of space to that in my head. In the process of learning to live for myself, I'd become very internal in terms of listening to what I wanted and who I wanted to become. So on the contrary, I think that, you know, that strength that I had as a person, and after I started Eka, the passion that I had to be what I wanted to be and the kind of clothes that I wanted to do, the kind of label and the voice I wanted to build. In fact, I think I had to unlearn that. I had to become more accessible. I had to become malleable again. I had to be more flexible to allow voices to bother me. Because Eka is its own journey. It has only so much to do with who drives it. But besides that, I think it's its own personality. So yeah, unconvention, I think, definitely is the starting point. But where it yields and where it grows, I think it's all a process of a lot of learning and unlearning that happens outside of who I am actually as a person.
So, you know, I want to talk about the styles at Eka, right? So I have to be honest, I didn't know about your label till Swati introduced us. And I could so relate to it, because to me, fashion is really not about feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But when I think of fashion, I think of discomfort, you know? But again, you've defied that norm. For you, design is comfort, because clothing is second skin. Did you never wonder in your own head that how will people accept the style, because it's very niche, it's very exclusive? I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I understand. So I'd first of all like to ask that who put this notion in our head that fashion has to be inaccessible and uncomfortable, and it is something that has to beautify you. Like, fashion was always a part of our lives, whether or not we were beautifying, you know, ourselves. Fashion is also about personality. Fashion is also about expression. I find rural India so fashionable. I don't know whether it is the tattoos, whether it is the way they'll wear their lungi, you know, it's a whole lot of things. It's culture, it's how you communicate, you know, about yourself. And I definitely don't think fashion is what we have bought fashion's definition in the last 10, 50, 40 years, maybe. This is more and more post World War scenario, where we thought fashion is supposed to uplift. I think no matter how big our lives are, or no matter how important our lives are in terms of what we do, our lives are ordinary. We eat 3 meals a day. We pay attention to how we feel. Like, health is important. Living it with the right kind of impressions of the elements, whether it is the sunlight, whether it is the nature, whether it is walking outdoor, whatever it is, I think all of us are kind of conscious. That is the kind of people that I speak with, I talk to. My audience is those people who are very aware of the life that we have on the planet Earth. And secondly, I feel maybe you dress up for those 3 to 4 days when you are going on a red carpet. I agree. And you want to feel special. But are the other days extremely ordinary? Are they so boring that you don't want to dress up for those days? when you sit alone and have your coffee in your quaint neighborhood cafe, or you meet somebody on the road, or you go out with a friend for a walk, and those clothes are a part of you. They're part of your memory. Like, you know, I think it was my fourth collection. I wrote to a lot of my friends from childhood, later on college, and people who are now living really far away. I asked them that, would you like to share me a story of something in your wardrobe? And in the process of that, I also sent this note to Arundhati, the writer.
Yeah.
And she sent me back a few lines. She said that there is this hideous shawl from my mother, and I've lived in it, and it's now used and overused. And it's my most cherished memory of her, because clothes do hold that value in our lives.
Yeah.
I know of so many people who wanted to get married in their mothers or their, you know, trousseau. It's also about the person that we are and what it took from our lives to become the person that we are in that moment. That it just cannot be dictated to someone like me. Like, I cannot have a very creative genius anywhere in the world dictate that this is what you become today, so you're fashionable, and this you will not wear next season. So I want it to be my decision. And I think there are a lot of people who want to hear this and who want to do that. They just want that confidence to feel that way. And I think Eka is for them. I am speaking to those women who want to feel confident in their own life stories.
I love that. Wow. I think what I'm hearing is that Eka has its own community and tribe. Like, you know, you're not there to look for people. People find Eka.
Yeah, 100%. That's true. Also, the other thing is that, you know, recently, like I said, Adma, when I was traveling and we do these shows where we reach out to our buyers and people, there are lots of shops. These shops are like small, quaint shops somewhere in some island in Greece and somewhere in the south of France. I see them like once a year or twice a year, you know, when I do my shows. But they come and they meet me like they know me, because they are the women who are wearing my clothes, and they're the women who sell my clothes, and they know women who buy my clothes, who come and tell them what happened to them when they were crossing the street and somebody stopped them or somebody photographed them. So they come back to me with these stories. So this time I remember I was talking to one of the women, and she complained about one sheer textile. And she said that, Reena, do you think it could be? And we were discussing it. And I said, no, but you can layer it. I just said it matter of factly. I said, you know, when you wear, she said, no, but you know, it is so hot now after this and that. She said, it's so hot that I will not suffer for the sake of beauty. And she said, now those days are gone. Now women don't want to suffer for the sake of beauty. I'm that person. I could never suffer for the sake of beauty. Like, I will never wear the kind of shoes that are the most trendy shoes for a season and then ruin my entire evening because I can't walk or stand. And I think there is a lot of women like that.
That's exactly what I meant when I said they make themselves uncomfortable, right?
Yeah.
Talk to me more about that whole experience of writing notes to your friends and people around. What was that journey like? That sounds so exciting. What was the purpose of that? What was the outcome of that?
So I did this collection. It was called Seekers Keepers.
Okay.
And you need inspirations, and you know, every season, even if you're making the same kind of a dress and the same kind of something, you still need some kind of inspirations that, you know, something should talk to you about where you want to start from. And I read a bit, and I've enjoyed a lot of stories in my life. I think when all hope is lost, then there are stories, and stories guide you, direct you. You end up living somebody else's life, you know, when you're reading somebody's biography or stories or whatever. So I thought that if I'm able to connect with people and their journeys and their stories, in my head, it's always building characters. I'm sure that when I'm telling you, this was my childhood, this is how I lived, this was, already in your head is a person. She's wearing a certain dress. She's sitting somewhere. You've kind of sketched it in your head, right? And I reached out to my friends who I thought were inspirational like that. I just felt like I could ask them, would you share something? You know, people wrote about their journeys to faraway lands. Like, this woman said that she moved to Canada many years ago, and she was invisible to the people there because her skin color, because the new country, because her confidence in the people who were not her own, because, you know, not knowing directions, not driving around, not knowing nothing. And then she said that when I would wear your clothes and I would walk the streets, people would see me because they would see your clothes. So I always connect to this. I think that if there is anything that really satiates you in the end, it's always that emotional high, because everything else fades. It's only the emotions that remain with you. And therefore, I collected a lot of these stories from my friends, personal people that I admire, artists, musicians. Some people just sent a few lines and I built from that. Some people just sent me a little story with their dyer or their person and how they arrived at a particular color, and I built a story from it. And we just made a collection, and I sketched those people in my head, and I gave them wardrobes. I hypothetically dressed them. I styled them flamboyantly. We presented the show. It was a very successful collection.
It sounds so beautiful, yeah. And I'm assuming all these people are part of your tribe, people who are wearing Ekka and adoring Ekka.
Or I made them a part of my tribe when I reached out to say that this is what I'd like to do. But more and more, I think I reached out to them because you always know that these are the kind of people who are your people. Yeah,
yeah, they'll appreciate your work and appreciate you. And I read that you read 5 books at a time sometimes.
Yeah, that's the craziest thing, yeah.
Yeah, so how does it influence you and any of your favorite reads or rereads? Or talk to us and inspire us so more people can learn from your journey.
You know, Enma, I started reading strangely because I was in a boarding school and I was not really a sports person. I used to hate sports periods. I would always make an excuse and say that my stomach hurts or something or the other. I would go hide in the library. And up until a point, you can look at comic books and, you know, illustrated things. After that, I just started reading too early. And I continued to read a lot of fiction. So building characters in my head and relating to them, I think, starts from there, actually, you know, maybe.
Right.
So I think college days was a lot of Ayn Rand and things like that, you know, War and Peace and Sense and Sensibility and great adaptations and, you know, Tess of the Tubabilis and Far from the Madding Crowd. A lot of such classic books. And, you know, because I was married really early, like I said, I was barely 15, 16 when I got married. It was a royal family and they had all kinds of these classic books in their original editions. And sort of reading, I think, got me out of the worst situations in my life. Like, I was never in reality. I was never hurt. I was never broken. I was never living the reality as it existed around me because I always had books that I would hide into.
Let's backtrack a little bit, Reena. And now that we've understood Ekka and the whole Ekka tribe, tell us about your first Ekka order.
Like I said, Ekka didn't happen immediately after college. I finished and I worked at NAIF, then I worked at ITC, which was a corporate house, and we used to travel a lot internationally. And then while I had my second son, during that period, I used to feel that, you know, whenever I wanted to go out and shop, I didn't find a lot of clothes that I wanted to wear. And I would go to my husband's factory, sit there and take a lot of textiles lying around and convert them into the kind of shapes that I could wear. And I got a lot of admiration. A lot of people said, oh, we love what you're wearing. We love that frock. But even after, I continued to enjoy wearing those clothes. And a lot of women said to me, where is this available? Can we get it? Can we buy it? So I made a small collection and I sold it to my friend's family and every last piece sold. And I did something in the embassy in India, American embassy. And I felt, wow, this is great audience. They understand what I'm doing, you know, because I always felt that the shapes are very universal, that I can't wear a sari, to be honest with you, on an everyday basis. Not that I don't love and enjoy it, but in my memory, it is something so elegant, pure, like I wouldn't want to mess with it. In my head, it's a very purist, but on an everyday basis, I still want to wear my textiles and the kind of fabrics that appeal to me. So I made these shapes, which were kind of international and more contemporary, in the textiles that came from the same place where the saris were woven. They were all hand-woven, block-printed, hand-spun Indian textiles. And the shapes were very modern. And I applied for this one show in London. They accepted me. They said that this is one eco-label that has come to us after so long. I carried my collection in 2 bags and I flew off and I was in London. So I landed in a really commercial fair, but I had a small booth and I was just a point of information for a lot of people that walked by and said, oh, wow, this is so beautiful. This is so lovely. How is this made and how is this done? But I didn't have any orders, to be honest. And it was like a 3-day show. And on the third day, I was literally disheartened because I had contacts and people were interested and people were dropping by, but there was nobody buying it. There was Victoria and Albert Museum. There were really good magazines. There were very big stores, but there was nobody buying anything. So one gentleman who came from the Fair Trade Organization, he stood with me. He was a little elderly and he spoke to me about India, about how these textiles are and how he's so experienced and how he can tell. Like we were discussing very passionately counts and how it is made and the villages where they're made and how it is all one ecosystem. So he said, have you met the right people here? I said, no, I haven't. He said, you should meet Maureen at the egg store. I knew about the egg store because there are a couple of people who before us, they did what I was doing now. People from the industry, they are the pioneers, I would say. People who put in a lot of work to make handicraft still available at the time when we wanted to do something with it. So I knew about it that at one point, Isemiyake had started a label called Heart, which was researched and produced in India. So he said, there is this shop on the Kinnerton Street. Just go, but go at this hour, leave then, because then it shuts at that point. Get on that metro and get out on the other side because you will be lost. He gave me really nice instructions, that gentleman. I still want to thank him. And he set me to go to meet Maureen at the egg store. And I went and I got out of the metro and I was walking around and I just couldn't find the street. I couldn't find where it was. And I walked, you know, past the store because it was a small little lane. And in that lane, I went twice and I couldn't see the what exactly is the store because it had just had a little signage that said egg. And it was perhaps a stable years ago. I didn't know. So I walked out and I came back on the street and I was running around in a frenzy because I knew that it's going to shut on time. And I saw this woman who was walking towards me. I was looking at her in her dress, in her over jacket, you know, carrying a lot of flowers in her head. And there was no way I was not going to notice it. And she looked at me, you know, walking around in my hand woven dress in a frenzy on a London street. I looked at her and I said, I'm looking for this store. Can you help me? She said, yeah, go into that street again. It's right there. I said, no, but I went there. There's nothing. She said, knock. So I went back in. I knocked and a girl opened and I went in. And the moment I entered, I was like, my God, this is exactly where I belong. I touched everything. I felt everything. I saw the display. I saw what the clothes were. I saw what the fashion was. And I felt that this is exactly the space where I want to hang my clothes because I had already tasted failure. There was no more dropping down below that, you know. You know, I was like, what's the worst? So I asked the girl who was at the shop floor. I said, I'm a designer from India. Do you think I could meet the owner? She said, ah, Maureen. I said, yeah, can I meet her? She said, she's sitting outside. I said, ah, okay, do you think I can speak to her? She said, yeah, go speak to her. So I just stepped outside and I saw Maureen. She was sitting with her cigarette, drinking a cup of tea. I said, I'm this designer from India and I'd like to show you my collection. She said, are you wearing what you make? I said, yeah. She said, you made this. She asked me again. I said, I made this. She said, come tomorrow at 11. I said, but I have a flight at 4:30. She said, come with your suitcases. Doesn't matter. So the next day at 11, I was in her shop with my suitcases. She helped me carry the suitcase upstairs. We sat in her office. The collection was all over the place. We were opening things and the girls were gushing over it. Literally, I heard a lot of it and the girls were trying the clothes and Maureen was giving me instructions in the sizing, make it larger, bigger, you know, whatever, hems and things. And I was writing my first order. This is how it happened. Wow. I couldn't believe it. I was pinching myself all the way to the airport thinking I've forgotten my passport, thinking I don't know where I wrote the notes. Did I give them the right price? But what I felt was I found my destination. If I was not there in that moment, I perhaps would have taken up a job. I would have started making something else. But I think it just happened at the right time to me. And so I think I was set in the right direction, not just once, several times in my life. So this was one such interesting incident. But Maureen was a mentor for the longest time. She was a confidant and she was the person I could reach out to. In fact, she passed last year and we'd had really interesting conversations. We were not just a buyer and a designer relationship. We were more than that. She could talk to me about her failures and she could talk to me about her success and she could talk to me about the woman she is and she is not. And I could do that with her.
That's beautiful. Your whole energy and your voice change, you know, I could see that the excitement in your voice when you narrated that story, you know, like you said, you found your North Star.
Yeah.
I read about one of your fashion shows, you know, was it Alice in the Wonderland?
Yeah.
So tell us about it.
I expressed myself really differently in that show. Look, that show came from a very hard place, actually, if I must tell you. I've never done something as dramatic as that. Never so much of dance and drama. But this came from a very, very hard place. After the COVID, I'd suffered, you know, I had like an injury. I kind of didn't do well after COVID. And that whole experience of 1 year was a lot of internalizing, a lot of emotions and, you know, how life is and how things pass and how we're supposed to live. I questioned everything, literally. And yet I never stopped going to work, not a single day. Like every day I would go and sit at work. And the one thing that I would enjoy was looking at how things are getting made and, you know, whatever it is. And when I started being myself again, I literally found a metaphor in Alice's fall, how she fell and how life just became literally a whole, you know, it's just a Super Bowl if you look at it like that, isn't it? So I just felt like there's so much more to life, literally. When you feel that you've seen it all, you've lived it all, you've experienced it, it just gives you one shocker and then you have to start again. And it was a fancy way of putting it all together to say that let's join the party now. There was this COVID, we all had this fall, we came out and we are looking on the other side now. Let's all join together. Let's go back and remember what we can. Forget what is not important. There's only one way forward. We can only progress from what we have experienced.
Yeah, beautiful. We spoke so much about rural lifestyle, you know, the craftsmen, their ambience. So share with us your experiences in working with the rural Indian craftsmen.
Enma, so the villages are now actually very well connected. But at the time when I started my label, we literally had to fly down to the airport, like 4 hours from here. And then from there, we would get into a jeep. From the jeep, we would travel around 4 hours. Then we would get into boat with the jeep.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, we would go to the other side, get off in the jeep. We would drive another 2 hours. Then we would be in the village. So if we would reach the village at about, say, noon, we had to get out of the village at 4 because once the sun sets, there are no roads to guide you back home, nothing. And also a lot of times, you know, we used to make these journeys, go there and realize that a lot of the young artisans were not interested anymore. And a lot of times what we sit and decide and travel so far and start doing together, they would fall apart in 2 months and 3 months. You wouldn't hear from them. It was not about advance. It was just that they are not interested. The young kids are not working with them. And the old ones didn't have the eyes or the hands to continue to work so much anymore. So me and my husband, I remember we flew down to meet one of our artisans, a block maker. And we said that, but you had promised to deliver by then. He said, what do I do? My son is not here and I can only do so much. And I said, but you know that we'll lose the order. He said, I can't help it. He said, I'll give you your money back and I'll work as long as I can. And he also cried and he said that, I think I'm better off shutting because I'm giving my parents and my forefathers bad name by doing this. Anyhow, we were having lunch with the whole family. So the son also came home because he knew that this big designers are coming from Delhi. He wanted to have lunch with us. We all sat down in the kitchen talking about his children. And he wanted one of them to be a pilot. That was his plan. And I'll move to Delhi and I'll put him in a school. Da, 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 da. And I said to him that you don't want to make blocks anymore. It's laborious in the end. He said, no, what's there in it? I don't make any money. I said, but you have a house, you have everything going for you. He said, no, but I want to travel, I want to do this, da, 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 da. And from that point onwards, we started paying a retainer to all the artisans that we work with across the board. So the whole ecosystem, the makers everywhere across the country, we don't have a system where we have them on our rolls. They are independent makers. But in this case, we made sure that there is always a minimum amount of wage that is going to the household. And I promised him that. At that moment, he wanted to buy a motorcycle. Me and Sandy handed over the cash and he said that, go ahead, buy the motorcycle, but you deliver this order. So in this moment, he resigned from the AC factory he was working in. He took the money, he got the motorbike, and he made that order, sat with his father, and he delivered. Before that order was passed on, and we went back again with the magazine that had printed the collection that we made from the work that he had done. We showed it to him. And in an interview, I had named him that he did it for us. And there was no turning back. Literally, he still works with us. He's one of the finest in what he does. Several such stories, Enma. Like the other weaver from this faraway village would call and say that there is a lot of mosquitoes in the village. And aap aaoge to you cover yourself nicely. And I would carry them jackets and I would carry them mosquito repellents and whatnot. And, you know, so this is how I think these relationships are in Ma. So not too far away from where I started, sitting in the afternoons, you know, weaving, printing, whatever, whatever. So the weavers who would come and put their looms in my maternal household when I was a kid, they were fed first before we would sit down and have our lunch. Likewise, when I go to the villages, we sit and eat with them. Also, when the goods arrive, for example, we've given a fabric for making and the fabrics come and half of them is not what we wanted in terms of color or pattern or things change. So there's an unsaid code of conduct. Nothing goes back to the artisans or the weavers ever. Nothing, because they don't have an inventory. They don't have a stock. They don't have shops. They made it for us. So it stays with me and I should find a way to
repurpose.
Yes, exactly. There is a lot. There is a lot that India is about. You know, I was recently involved also with IAM in this program where we were talking about this. And I said, there's no code book. If I could just spell it out and say, this is how the profit and losses are done. I think a lot of it is intuition at work. That's what I tell you that, you know, it was perhaps my childhood that shaped me. And even today, a lot of these interesting stories.
Tell us some more.
Or kya tha? So recently, so when I did this one Telangana collection 2 years ago, I was commissioned by the government to work with the Telangana clusters. So, you know, we were looking for this one technique, which is a very age-old technique and it's not done anymore. More and more people find shortcuts now because otherwise it becomes, it is difficult. And I don't blame people because, you know, their markets are just local. I would say state-centric. Like ikat is made and sold maximum in the southern states of India.
Right.
There's so much of craft in the country. And in its origination, if you see, everything was tied to the region where it is made. And why it is being made there? Because the environment suits it. You can make blocks out of that kind of wood. You can wash it 15 times because the river flows like that. You can get the 5-8 colors because the sunlight is like that. You can do those 8 colors because you have all the original natural crops around you to give you those colors. Like they could be a red, they could be an indigo, they could be madder, they could be ochre. You know, so each one of them was extremely rich in Ma. All the regions of India, whether it is ajrak from the west, whether it is hand-woven 500 counts of khadi from the east, whether it is double ikat with all its dexterous motif language from the south, whether it is Banaras with its silk, the thinnest counts of silk warps and multiple jacquards that they're able to do. And they don't want to reinvent a wheel. They are so skilled in where they are. And in that sense, they're not even threatened because they know that nobody else in the world can do it. It's only them, you know. So very recently, we were in Telangana and we were looking for this one particular kind of a textile craft that we wanted to, I'm not saying revive, but I wanted to do it. I was very passionately looking for artisans who were involved in doing it. And in the process, I just met this weaver who was the son of another very creative weaver. He spoke very broken English, Hindi, something, and he spoke only Telugu. So he spoke to the person who was coordinating the project and he said that I still have my father's blueprint of how it is made. And I have his notes written in the book, in his handwriting. I can show you. Come with me to my village. But, you know, everybody was rubbishing him. Ki kahan iska gaon? Where will we go? This and that. And because we already had an itinerary for the day. And I just saw it in him because the way he was talking about it. And he was also, he carried a portly from his pocket and he was showing, you know, this color and this is how it is done and everything. I was like, let's just quickly go and see what he's doing. And I went there and we spent the whole day sitting with him and he opened the manuscript and he showed us the master pattern, you know, that his father had left for him. And he told me the story of what he knew, that this was made only for the traders who would come from the Muslim countries. They would buy this, wear it, and it is oiled because it kept their head cool because they used to cross over the Arabian Sea. You know, the history that only he could tell. I would not read it anywhere else. And why the motifs are what they are, because it was the entire constellation that was their guide in the journey. And why that is the only motif language. It's called the Telia Rumal. But it was so interesting. And then we were sitting there, we had tea with him and his daughter came and she spoke in English. She had a Facebook account. She made friends with me on Facebook and she said that I want to join NEFT. And I said, I'm going to write a recommendation letter. I made sure that she got an entry into NEFT and she's now a NIFTian and she writes to me. I'm sure she'll take it forward. She's seen her father struggle through all this.
Yeah.
So yeah, these are the stories and many more like that. Many more.
Yeah. You know, what I'm hearing is that what Maureen did to you, you're doing it down the lines.
I think, you know, what happens is, Enma, when you meet these people and when you see, you know, they're artists. They're really, really talented, skilled artists that carrying the tradition of their forefathers. I think it's in their genes that they know how to deal with those materials. That local intelligence and knowledge cannot be found in books anywhere. You cannot learn it in colleges. People don't seek them in their purest forms anymore. So what I do at ECHA is, because I love these things and I know that it's hard to sell, I'm just a person who creates a story around that product and makes it look something that people would want to access, buy, wear.
Yeah.
So if fashion is the tool to do that, yes, I'm a fashion label. Yes, in that sense, I'm absolutely in the world of fashion because I can imagine stories out of that product. But I think that these people, if they're not there, a lot of our history is not what it was. And they have to survive. They have to go to the generation next. And these stories are not going to be stories of sympathy. They're going to be stories of the merit of the product, the beauty of the product, the voice of the product, that it will invite its audience to seek it anywhere in the world, I feel. And it's only humility and seeking that knowledge that can take you that far again and again. Otherwise, these are not very pleasant experiences, to be honest, in terms of travel, food, sanitation.
Yeah.
You know, it's becoming more and more hard for me to do this. But I think somewhere I enjoy them so much that I feel these are like literally like the biggest validation, accreditations, awards, or, you know, anything that you get. Because this is something that you feel you acquire as a skill that the third person sitting next to you on the international, when you're there with your brand, and there is another really talented designer from anywhere else in the world, you stand there with pride because you know that you have this knowledge which people in the world don't. So, yeah.
Yeah, I can see you lighten up every time you share these stories. Reena, I want to ask you a difficult question and please feel free to not answer it. While I appreciate all these craftsmen and I recognize that you're giving them a platform, right? If it weren't for you, their stories wouldn't have even traveled across oceans and so on and so forth. But have you ever come across any of these craftsmen being dismissive? Does that make sense? And
the truth is that we all rise together. It's not just me who gains from it. I'm saying it in all humility and all honesty. I'm just passionate about what I do.
Yeah.
Yes, it brings me money. And do I hate it? No. But do I keep it? No. I invest it back in my resources and the people. I've never changed my language in the last 11 years that I started ECHA. I've always gone back and worked with the same people, the same craftsmen, the same artisans. I've never negotiated with them. You know, once I remember, we were very excited about doing the season with a certain motive language. And I went back and forth with the weaver and it was such a heated argument about something. I put my phone down and I said, I'm never going to work with him again. So, you know, these relationships are literally like family.
Yeah.
So they will always call you Didi. Mm. I will call them Bhaiya. There's no hierarchy, like I'm the boss. It's always family. So one such occasion, he reached out to my husband and he said that Didi ne bahut rudely baat kiya. So Sandeep, my husband, at the right moment, he came to me and he said that I heard this happened. I said, yeah, because this, you know, it's endless. Now they have so much exposure. There's so many designers who are doing same kind of work. So they think they can just increase their prices season after season. But how do I justify? I don't have a magic wand that I can say that, okay, last season, this was that much. And now it is going to be this expensive and da-da-da. Because it's not just the textile. We do 15 other things over and above it. And there's a huge marketing cost. And there's so much. I mean, we work in a very organized setup. Like me and Sandeep, like I said, that we are educated abroad. And we carry back a lot of that value system with us, that we don't work like a very random organization where, you know, the money is literally like one person's. So when I said that, you know, where you just ask the person who handles the fabrics, like, is this even something that we can put in the average and we can make a cost sheet around it to sell? So he said, yeah, I understand. And then he said that, Reena, have you seen very closely the kind of count that you're working with? I said, yeah, I know. It's only possible on a 300 count. Then he said, and the motive that you want to do, you know that it will only happen when it will be like this. I said, yeah. He said, and it is reasonably that many hours of work. I said, yeah, I understand that. He said, it is only that many processes, spinning, dyeing, we usko maan dete hain, like you put rice starch. and this, that, and whatever. And he says, easily only that much in about 5 days? I said, yeah. He said, now, if you were to do this job, sitting on, just make a plain fabric on the loom, because we've always been extremely passionate and you wanted to build a floor where we had looms. And he said that if you were to sit and do weaving like a meter of fabric in the day, what would you charge, Reena? And how much would you charge? And it was a moment of honesty. And, you know, I could reflect on it and I could understand that you can't negotiate. You don't do it. If you don't justify the price, you don't become the designer. You cannot sell it, but you want to do something which is so dexterous and tough. You don't do it in 20 colors. But you don't go back to the artisan and say that, I want this, but you do it in that colors. I want it in that count, but you do it like this. I want to do it exactly like, you know, in this kind of craftsmanship, but I can't pay you that much. So this doesn't work. We all rise together, Enma. So of course, I'm honest about it that we do make profits, and touch wood, we have never been in losses. We might have made a little less profit at some point in certain years, but it takes a whole lot of equation to put things together, Enma. I say this with all honesty, humility, experience, and knowledge, that if I'm out of the equation, I don't make money and the artisan doesn't make money. That's not good for anyone. I'm better off making money and I'm better off giving money to the hundreds of talented, skilled people in the country. We are never short of people who want to work. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it is villages or even in the urban, this thing, a lot of them are coming to the cities, seeking jobs as tailors. Every single tailor in my company is trained by us, 6 months on probation, trained by us. And then they stay. They're not the kind of people who would work here today and go somewhere else tomorrow. There's social security, there is medical, there is leaves, there is family. We work like a system. And I'm so proud of having built it. And so proud of having those kind of values where I feel I know my place in the chain, and it's a chain. And likewise, I depend on so many other shops and customers who come back to appreciate what I do. So that's why I use fashion as a tool. And I feel extremely privileged to be a part of this whole, you know, in my own way, I can contribute. So I don't think it works for anybody. If I fail, or if I make little less money, or if I make it cheap and accessible, and if I make their work cheap and accessible, I don't think this works. I think they have to be paid, because it's the only country in the world where we are able to do what we are able to do. It's highly skilled, dexterous craft, which doesn't have to survive. It has to thrive. It has to become art. And I think I'll play my role and I'll relay it to the generation next, and they'll do something else with it.
That's beautiful. That's a true journey of passion. You've given them that platform. You're helping them take it to the next level.
Yeah. Like I said, so, you know, I'm always participating in these international shows where if they are not accepting of me, if they feel they're giving me an opportunity or they're giving me a platform. So this inclusivity works at every step.
Exactly.
This,
yeah,
where you pay a price to be included in. Somebody gives me their art. Somebody gives me their skill. I add in my knowledge, my creative influences, and I make something of it. And I go out to ask to be included in a bigger universe where somebody else is open to that idea. And they take a profit from me. And I think this whole chain profits.
Yeah.
If we all do what we are built to do in the most authentic and most honest ways, to do the best of our capabilities, learn, evolve, recreate each time, I think it's a good win-win situation. And it's not for me to keep it. I think the more I'm able to populate an idea of what Indian artisans do, what Indian crafts is, what Indian fashion is, what kind of a language India speaks, the visibility increases, more people want it. And yeah, that's the ecosystem.
Did you ever worry, Reena, that you will lose these artisans to other designers? Because that's also a possible reality, right?
Now, like I said, their children are now studying at DIFT and everywhere, and they would be designers tomorrow. I'm threatened? No, not at all. I'm not threatened at all. Not at all insecure. Because I think over the period of, you know, time, when you reinvent yourself so many times, that insecurity really washes away. Mm-hmm. I think creativity really is the only answer, Enma. There's nothing else. There's nothing to hold on to in this world. In terms of, I feel as a creative person, there's nothing, no merit, no accolade, no validations I can hold on to as strongly as recreating. So yeah, that I think is my strongest weapon.
Beautiful. So as we end the conversation, Reena, I heard Sandy's name so many times. So how did Sandy support you in your journey?
Like they say, you know, in our lives, actually guides arrive when we are seeking them.
Yeah.
A guide could be anybody.
Absolutely.
You know, it's also somebody you share your journey with. Sandy and I have literally grown up together. So I walked out of my first marriage. It was actually a marriage of abuse. And I was too young to be able to decide. But I just knew what I couldn't live with anymore. Like I said, I found this college where I started my fashion education journey. And Sandy and I were together in that whole 2-3 years. And even after that, I think we came from the same place and we had the same value system. He supported me. Like, that's what I say, that when we just talk about stereotypes, then Indian men really don't come across as men who would support women in their journeys, forget careers. They don't even empower them in their personal lives, you know. But in this case, I must say and acknowledge and give the man his due that I don't know where my dream became his. And I don't know where he found that. I really found strength through him. I mean, he's a beautiful person that is there, but to find support, especially with a man, when I was so badly broken by a man, that was the last thing that I expected from life, really. And in a place like, you know, our country, it's really not the kindest to women who have stories like mine. And he gives me wings and he empowers me. He's very kind. His value system is so foolproof that I don't think that when you asked me, I was so confident in saying that I can never use the people who built my label because I know that I work with a man who works so fairly. So yes, in that sense, he's really a mentor. And yeah, he lets me be. He lets the crazy in me live. So I think as long as the crazy in me lives, I'll maneuver my way around the world.
That's really, really special. I love the way you said that he made my dream his dream. My intention was not to get you all overwhelmed.
No, thank you so much.
Yeah. So, Reena, like you know, Atlanta Diaries is a place where aspiring women leaders learn and unlearn their definitions of success. What are your parting thoughts for these leaders as they transition into larger roles?
You know, I feel that women largely, whether it is in our, you know, in our country or anywhere else in the world, I think we are not really dealt with very fairly. We don't have the right opportunities. I feel especially strong women, you know, who have a voice of their own, whether it comes circumstantially or just because they fall on the right side of things, are silenced more than they are empowered. So many times it's also the women who don't work together to support each other. I feel that more and more it is extremely important to give our daughters, you know, that kind of confidence to look straight into the eyes, to err more, to be super confident because you've made enough mistakes. Because we don't do that. We always tread so softly. We tread so wisely right from childhood to do the right things, to fall on the right side of things so that we are not hurt, so that we are not blinded, so that we are not used, so that we are not abused, so that we are not saying the wrong things that can, you know, bring us into trouble. I feel just on the contrary, women should support women to be that much more outwardly, to make noise, to claim space, to be loud, you know, even if that's not me. I have lots of girlfriends who are really literally out there, you know, and sometimes I'm scared for them because I know what the world is. But yet at the same time, I feel this is what power is. You have to empower these women so that it is a norm. You don't always have to be right. You don't always have to take care of others. Why would women still be living in the world where they are still nurturing and nourishing? And, you know, because men also want to be soft and men also want to be emotional. And likewise, I feel there's so much that I want to say, but, you know, this is perhaps all that I can at the moment share and what comes out of me right now.
Thank you, Reena. I really enjoyed listening to your courageous journey. I know it was hard, but all I can still hear is a woman who is so spirited, who's so creative, who just found her own North Star. And that's absolutely amazing.
Thank you very much. I really didn't know I had so much in me to share also, you know, while talking to you, I felt that it was literally sharing stories. And like I said, I'm extremely passionate about that. I feel you learn, you only learn through that. So thank you for this platform.
Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries. Thank you.